This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Usual Suspects, how to cast call for your novel.
Okay, so we should put forward what we actually mean by this title, because I think there might be a few people who are sort of raising their heads in interest and going, oh, you mean like casting actors? And that is not what we're talking about today at all.
No, I mean, that would be a lovely problem to have, but that's a discussion for far in the future.
far in the future, yes. We're looking at something a little bit more practical for the everyday layman.
Yes, so this is basically about finding the right cast for your book. The idea for this episode is, weirdly, this came from the fact that what I'm working on at the moment started off as something else that wasn't going to work, so I put it to one side and didn't touch it again. Mm-hmm. And then years later, having had other books out and done other things, that idea came back to me again, and I realised that the reason it wasn't working was because it had the wrong person as the protagonist. So I'll go into that a little bit more later and explain what I mean, but
that
made me think about having the right characters for your book.
Yeah.
So
and actually, weirdly enough, this was something that I also did a lecture on very recently, with regards to actually considering who you tell your story through, because it might not always be who you're expecting. So well, let's go into it a little bit more.
Yeah, definitely. So why is having the right cast for your book so important?
Well, I think the primary thing is that you want your readers to be able to engage with your character. Then you want them to engage with your writing.
Yeah, definitely. If you want to take your readers on a journey with your story, then you need to provide characters that they care about. Mm-hmm. Ideally characters they like, but that's not always a given.
No.
Because if you've got an anti-hero as your protagonist, then they might not like them, but they need to be invested in them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, because your characters are the vehicle for your story. So, as Jules says, even if they're not the nicest of people, even if you don't actually necessarily like them, you do have to be invested in them. For example, a long, long time ago, when I was reading the Song of Ice and Fire books, there would be sections which were written from Cersei's point of view. Now, I detested Cersei as a character, but her story was interesting. It was intriguing to see her point of view. It was intriguing to see the events unfurl. And so even though I didn't like her, I wasn't rooting for her, I was still invested in what was happening with her.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there are obviously other things at play there as well, but we'll get into that in a bit. There's a key phrase here, and that's target audience. Mm. So you shouldn't have a character that's so immediately unlikable to your target audience that they stop reading. So you should, you know, this is part of knowing who you're writing for. Let's be honest, there's an awful lot of romance books out there where I'm not going to like the main character and I'm not going to be invested or want to keep reading.
No.
But I'm not the target audience, so it's really irrelevant what I think.
Yes. Yeah, and I've definitely been in the same situation. I do think that actually this is what sort of fuels a lot of people saying, oh, this YA stuff, it's so insipid, the characters are so unoriginal. And, you know, people, for instance, Twilight, people shit on Twilight constantly, talking about how annoying Bella is and how uninteresting Edward is, etc. And all I can think of is, yeah, but it's not for you.
It's like, yeah, Karen, you picked up the wrong book and you were too dumb to put it down again.
Like, fine, it's okay to read things and to say, well, this isn't, you know, I'm not enjoying it. And you're allowed to be critical about these things. But you should also be conscious of the fact that the worth of something isn't measured solely by your opinion of it, particularly if it wasn't designed for you to begin with.
Yeah, there is definitely a disconnect, particularly on the internet.
Yes.
With people who pick up books that I presumably they think they're going to like them to start with, unless they're hate reading,
mm-hmm.
and then realise halfway through that the book isn't for them, and they either finish it or don't finish it, and then they complain about it, and then the bit that I really don't get is they're surprised when the world doesn't universally adopt their opinion.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I know it's really important to you, but everybody else has an opinion as well. That's kind of what an opinion is.
Yeah. And the thing that really annoys me is when people have read a book which was not designed for them, and then they mock readers who the book was designed for liking it. So yeah. People, yeah, read this and go, oh, this trashy teen fic, it's terrible, and we're going to mock young girls for enjoying it. Like, no, it's just not for you. Shut up.
Yeah. So, you know, that's just one reason why you need to have the right protagonist for your target audience to tell your story.
Yeah.
The other things to think about, your cast needs to fit the story. So unless you're writing really absurdist fiction, you're not going to have a Regency rake turning up and holding a very proper tea party during a space opera.
But you could.
But you could. And the more I've said this, the more I've thought, you know what, I could change this just slightly and just have a rake-type character and
yes.
Really do Jane Austen in space. And I'm so tempted now. All that aside... I have way too much to work on. All that aside, yeah, you need to try and fit your characters to the time period.
Yeah.
And also where you're setting it and the plot itself. So, I mean, that's a very obvious example, but there are more subtle examples, I think, that don't really make sense.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think the problem is that this is not to say that you can't have unique or different characters, or that you can't say, actually, I am going to take a Regency gentleman and put him in a space opera. That would be quite interesting. And, you know, it's a dynamic that they used to explore a little bit in things like Doctor Who. It is possible to do these things. And actually, the real problem is making sure that your story fits, the kind of plot fits, the kind of direction fits, because your story should also be linked with your character, obviously. There's going to be a sense of character growth. And if these things don't actually gel together, no matter how unique or different your character is, it is possible to make them gel. But if they don't gel together, what's going to happen is that your reader is just going to either like the character or like the story, but feel totally disconnected. You know, there's going to be this disconnection between the two of them, which will actually make it really hard to engage with either in a satisfactory way.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that's something we'll sort of expand out a little bit later. But yes, absolutely, you're... protagonist should have an intimate relationship. That sounds weird.
Yeah.
Should definitely be intimately connected with your plot. Your plot should not be able to happen without your protagonist, otherwise you've got something wrong there.
Yeah. If the plot is just happening and your protagonist is just along for the ride, then it actually starts to get a little bit uninteresting, to be honest.
And, you know, apologies, I didn't mean to make it sound like the protagonist and the plot were sneaking behind the bike head to grab a quick snog before class or anything.
But I think that's they are.
But they are, definitely. Okay, you might have readers who are ambivalent about your MC, or they might not like them very much at all, and that's fine. I feel a lot like this about the Court of Thorns and Roses books, and what kept me invested was that, you know, the general plot was interesting and the characters did fit the plot, but there were supporting cast that I did get quite invested in.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely, I can see that. And obviously, I feel quite similar. As in, like, I wasn't that I think during the second book, I sort of cared more about them. But I always had a sort of on-off relationship with Feyre from the very start. But I tended to like the other characters a little bit more, and obviously particularly Lucien. To be honest, I'm surprised that when you were giving an example, you didn't mention Harry Dresden.
I don't have an ambivalent relationship with Harry. There are some things he does that I wish he didn't do, but I don't feel two conflicting things for him at the same time. I generally like him as a character.
Okay, all right. I wasn't sure.
No, know, I'd just like him to not be a 14-year-old boy in a man suit. You know, that's the thing I really want him to do.
Harry, you need to grow up a little bit.
So my other problems with that series have far more to do with the author than the main character, and that's a separate issue.
Okay.
It's like, for fuck's sake, they're called breasts. They're fine. They're not orbiting the Earth or doing any weird shit.
Aren't they? Can you prove that?
Can you prove they are?
I don't have to.
Neither do I. You know, if it was kidney... Okay, I could really go off on a rant here, and I'm not going to. Let's pull this back. Yeah, so as we were saying before, your protagonist should be the best people to tell the story. Mm-hmm. There's lots of sub-levels to this, and again, that's something we'll get into as we go further into the discussion. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they should be really connected to the plot. They should be the best person to tell that story from the plot. Here's where it gets a bit interesting. Your plot might have several different versions, as in your plot might have several different stories, and different characters might all be telling slightly different stories.
Yeah.
I know this because if you look at my back catalogue, I have any number of novellas and short stories and things that came about because this happened. I mean, I'm pretty sure that the entire connection between, you know, the Kestrel universe and the Unveiled universe and all the spin-off stuff that I'm writing at the moment all came about just because other characters had different experiences of the same story.
Yes. And other characters were doing different things in the background.
Definitely. But no one was telling M's story better than she was because no one was experiencing her story in the way she was. And I think that's the important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. And I think that's also why you can get very successful books which obviously have completely varied points of view. And the Song of Ice and Fire books really, really demonstrates that. It's all part of the same world. But you're on completely different adventures whoever you're with. One girl, you're watching her become an assassin. Another one, it's all court politics. One is literally fighting walkers. Not walkers, but sorry. Yeah, White Walkers. Sorry, I got mixed up with
The Walking Dead.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
It's close, they're just not ice zombies.
Yeah. So, you know, there's all these different stories and obviously it's different tones with each of them. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah. And our final point on this particular section is that your supporting cast should actually support. So they should all be hindering or driving the main plot, as well as providing supporting subplots, which, you know, resolve with the main plot arc.
Yeah. Yeah. As sometimes we do just want to add characters in for the sake of adding characters, but if they're not contributing anything, then save them for something else.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so how do you choose characters for your story? There is an interesting sub-question here before we get on to this, and that is, how does story come to you? And there is no right answer. Sometimes a character pops into your head, fully formed, complete with luggage and names and everything and a backstory, and insists that you write about them. And sometimes you get the seed of an idea. You know, you really like the idea of exploring something. This is your classic what if. And sometimes it's a case of, I really want to write something around this particular theme. And some people are plot first, as in, there is this world, there is this happening in it, who's telling that story? And they have to find characters that actually fit into that story. So there's no right way for doing things. We're going to assume you don't really know your characters yet, and that's the position we're talking from.
Yeah. Or that you might only have the vaguest sense of your characters as well.
Yeah.
Sorry, just listening to you list all those different types. I have different names for them in my head, and one of them is Jules Gets Possessed by Ghost but Wants Story Told.
You can't prove that.
You can't disprove it.
I don't know. I think I do something which, in my head, I call fugue writing. Fugue writing is when I sit down to write, and then 20,000 words later, I look up and realise the day's gone missing and I can't remember what I've written. And it's really weird. Okay, I'm exaggerating that very slightly, but that is largely what happens. And then you realise that what you've written needs very little work or editing. It's just come out as though it's meant to have come out, like you're like you're kind of spirit channeling, which is obviously not what's happening. Clearly my subconscious just goes, we want to drive right now.
Yep, it's ghosts. Anyway,
it's not ghosts.
Okay, so back to the point that we were making. Anyway, so let's get back to what we were actually saying. So you're approaching a story, you've only kind of got the vaguest sense of who your character is, or you haven't even met them yet.
Yeah, so, you know, you should be writing something that you like and either are or would be vitally interested in. So it, basically, if you're writing something you think you should be writing rather than something you want to write, you may as well stop now.
Yeah.
Genuine, unless we're talking coursework or something.
Yeah, no, then don't stop.
Then don't stop, just do it. Even if you don't really want to do it, do it. But if this is you sort of like, I want to progress as a writer, then you should be writing about things that interest you. You shouldn't be writing literary fiction because you think that's what you should be writing. You should be writing what you like, what you enjoy, what you would like to read yourself.
Yeah.
You know, the story that no one else has told yet that you want to tell.
Yeah, the first person who should be invested in your story and in your character is you.
Definitely.
Very simply put.
And in the same way, you should choose characters who you are personally invested in. So you should write about characters that you either like or that you find fascinating in some way, or that you think are best for telling the story and, you know, that you can feel a connection with yourself. And if you don't feel those things, then your readers aren't going to either.
Yeah, exactly. So how do you start with doing this? Well, the way I do it, and something I just love to sort of to approach when I'm beginning a story, is archetypes.
Yeah, archetypes can be a really good place to start. And, you know, it's quite easy to just, you know, Google standard archetypes or Google Jungian archetypes, and you can get a list up, and it gives you a list of qualities with each sort of archetype. So, you know, you'd have the young woman archetype or the maiden, you'd have the joker, the trickster, the teacher, the magician, the traveller, etc., etc., etc. You can also define archetypes from the fiction that you read as well. So you might think, I would really like an archer to be part of this story. And, you know, I've always really quite liked Robin Hood, but obviously I don't want to write Robin Hood. Who else do I sort of like in that kind of role? What things have they got going? Where would they fit on a Jungian archetype type scale?
Yeah. This doesn't mean, you know, that you're then for limiting yourself in terms of, oh, well, I'm just repeating the same kinds of stories that are always get told. Because the archetype is just the starting point. And something I quite like to do when it comes to archetypes is choose an archetype which isn't necessarily the one set for the main role, but is usually an archetype reserved for a side character. So, just as a small example, in The Sons of Thestian, Rufus, in a lot of ways, is much more of a mentor character, and he's the bookworm and stuff like that. He isn't initially really main character material, except that he is, as far as I'm concerned. And it was basically about sort of switching things around and going, instead of the sort of the brave, you know, royal hero, the main story is actually going to follow this bookish nerd who has to adapt and change. So you can absolutely do that as well. When you're looking at archetypes, it's just a way of sort of finding like the buttery biscuit base of your cake.
And other things you can do is obviously think about the characters you love in fiction. And then you can look at why. I mean, this is why we say you should read widely and obviously watch lots of different things. However you take on your speculative fiction, whatever media you use, and it really doesn't matter, try asking yourself why you like those characters, why you're drawn to those sort of stories, what it is that the writer has done to capture your attention. Because once you understand what you like and why, you can then think about how you would like to rework that, not rework the character, but rework some of those tropes and ideas and characteristics to create characters of your own.
It is like baking. It's like being able to identify what flavours in something you like and then just using those flavors in your own cooking. Exactly. And I say this as someone who is terrible at cooking, like really, really bad at it, but the metaphor stands.
I wouldn't have said you were terrible. Well, I mean, I've only had something you cooked like once, so I'm like, I don't know, it's a qualified positive. Yeah, no, most people who say they're terrible at cooking, what they're really terrible at is having patience enough to go through the process. And you could argue the same thing about characterization.
Yes, this is true. What I'm terrible at is identifying what is the flavour that I actually like. I'm just really bad. I'm not a natural cook. But I am fairly good at identifying the flavours in characters that I like and baking up my own. That is an area that I am proficient in.
See, now you're underselling yourself, because I said you're an absolute bloody bloodhound for finding characters. It's like, I sense small, helpless but adorable orphan potential here.
It is true. When it comes to characters, like, I am a bit of a... Oh, I smell this somewhere deep underneath all of that. And you were like, what? I sent you like 30 words.
It's like a skinny, nerdy historian with a heart of gold. Big chip on his shoulder. Yes, big tick. Again, that was two sentences. Where are you getting this from?
Big tick. Unrequited love, I see. Wait, what?
Madeline is the cold caller of fiction. Seriously. If you send her something that might even vaguely fall into her wheelhouse, she will tell you everything about its life. It's terrifying. I can't remember what it was that you sent to me the other day. Oh, yes, it was. It was, oh, is it this character? And I literally said, like, five words, and I came back with a really shouty, oh, you sat in my head right now.
To be fair... A couple of months ago, you did say that you might be reintroducing them somewhere.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just completely out of the blue, but yes. I lurk in the darkest corners of your mind, waiting.
You see, I wouldn't put you in the darkest corners because that's not a fun place to be.
Also, anyway. I'm not subtle, so it's not dark. If I wasn't the darkest.
Back to how we like to create... Sorry, I'm trying to get us back on track here. Back to how we like to create characters. So I'm a little bit of a spaghetti method artist, if you'd even call it artistry, where I have a certain number of ingredients and things, and I like to shove it all in a bowl and then throw the whole lot at the wall and see what sticks.
Oh, nice.
So obviously I don't actually do this with cooking, because there wouldn't be many houses I would be allowed to go into after that.
I was going to say, your partner must love you.
But no, metaphorically, with character ingredients, this works for me. And you have to find the thing that works for you. I know people who put characteristics in a hat and pull out three and say, okay, well, this is going to be a courageous character who's really paranoid about cats and, you know, like small children kind of thing. And they go from there and build something. So you can try lots of different methods, and it's fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, it's... I actually kind of go on a walk with my characters, as it were, as in I meet them. They just sort of slip out as I'm starting to write. And then I continue to write them. And as I sort of build it up, I go, okay, so they have this background. So I guess that means this and that. And you start to sort of, it's like braiding something. It just starts to take shape with all of the individual strands as the whole world comes together. So I like to build my characters along with the building of the world and their plot. Because, that these are also intrinsically linked. So that's how I tend to approach creating characters.
Yeah. So what we're saying is there's no one right way. There's not even one right way for a particular book.
No.
Or, you know, a particular writer. It can change depending on what you're doing. I mean, in my case, a lot of my characters just sort of show up. You know, I'll manage to get my standard 5 hours of sleep and I'll wake up and it's like, there's another character there. Which makes me sound a little bit potentially schizophrenic, but...
You just knock on the door, you're like, ugh, I'll get it.
There's another one. Yeah, it's like lock and key. There's a whole bunch of doors in my head. And that's great. And it's wonderful when they turn up with everything in place, because you have to do so much less work. Your subconscious has already done all of it.
Yes.
But it doesn't always work like that.
Yeah, and actually sometimes they can show up and you think you know who they are, and then they completely surprise you.
Yeah.
Again, example of that, Zachary in book one. When I first wrote The Sons of Thestian, he was just a bad guy. Like, super sadist. He just wanted to do nasty things, honestly. He was so jaded and bitter and just liked to stroke his fear into everybody. And then as I started to write him in book two, because I thought that would be a good point of view in terms of just seeing what was happening in Hamartia, I discovered someone completely different who was hiding behind this kind of facade instead. And it was mind-blowing. I'd already written an entire book with him in it.
Yeah.
And he was someone completely different to what I had initially thought. It was one of the strangest experiences I've ever had in writing.
Yeah. And, you know, the reverse can be true in the sense of you've got a character shape, and you've got mm-hmm. a role for them to fulfil, and they just will not let you in to the point where they won't give you a name or anything like that. And you can try doing a character interview where you kind of metaphorically sit down with them and open with a really inane question and then follow through some deeper ones until you literally ask them what you want to know about them. And that can be a very mixed bag.
Yeah.
Which is something I did with I Belong to the Earth, because I just could not get Hayes to actually admit to anything. It's just completely avoidant and dismissive all the way through, right up until the point where he got pissed off with me interviewing him and threatened me. So there you go. It's all good fun.
Yeah, when I'm having trouble with my characters like that, what I tend to do is I'm like, I don't know who you are, so I'm going to put you in danger and see what happens. Into the fire pit you go. How do you react? Let's see.
So that is that classic, you can live with a man for 20 years and never know him, and then you can tie him up and put him on the edge of a volcano and finally you'll meet the man kind of thing.
Yeah, it was... I was thinking more in terms of one of those fridge magnets I saw, which is you never know. Women are like tea bags. You never know how strong they are until they get into hot water.
Yeah.
But yeah, sure. Volcano, man tied to chair. That works as well.
Okay. So, you know, hopefully that's given whoever's listening some ideas on how to find your cast for your book, call your characters in. Let's look at some of the problems writers have with casting calls for their books.
Yeah. So the first one is actually something, it's not actually happened to me per se, but I do know someone it's happened to and it really annoyed them, which is that you stubbornly spend your whole time following the wrong protagonist, usually because it's the first character you created. Originally it was going to be their story, but as things have developed, it's actually becoming somebody else's story, but you're sticking to the first person.
Yeah.
When you shouldn't be.
I've got two examples here. I've seen this done in some young adult fiction where clearly I think some of this is editorial and publisher input, where they say, we want a book about this sort of character. But that's not the sort of character that the author's actually really that invested in.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that the author, having managed to get a deal with a really big publisher, is kind of like, okay, I'm willing to change it because I'm willing to do my dues now and produce a book that you want to publish. And then when I sell, I'll start writing more what I want to.
Yeah.
I'm not going to look down on anyone for this. Obviously, I've been commissioned to write books. Mm-hmm. But my sticking point is on trading characters. So in the sense of, if this is how a character is coming out, then that's kind of like it or lump it situation for me.
Yeah.
I don't want to cast any stones. I'm just thinking of this one particular book that I read not last year, the year before, and I got an arc of it, and there was a really, really interesting female character in it, really gripping and, you know, sort of competent and complicated and layered, and she mm-hmm. got, I don't know, maybe 20 pages of screen time. The main character was boring. The main character wasn't even really invested in the plot. The main character, I was just like, why are we following this complete nobody around? What's going on? And I genuinely think that either the author was like, I must write about this sort of character, or the publisher had been saying, no, we want to publish your book if you change it to be about this sort of character, which does actually happen.
Yeah.
So that's one example. The other example is me. And obviously I never got to the publication stage. But when I originally envisaged a series of books about cryptids and somebody who's going around following cryptid adventures and getting into danger and all sorts of shenanigans going on, I had the character. I had Rebecca Harker. I had everything sort of more or less worked out about her.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from the fact that she's pansexual. That was the bit I didn't know. That came out very, very quickly when I started writing this series.
Yes.
I'm following you now. And I came up with this idea and, you know, with pretty detailed notes on what sort of things she might be up against way, 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 way before any of my books were ever published. So we're going back a long time.
Yeah.
And every time I started writing, and I even knew what was happening in the first book, in the first episode of her adventures, I had that all completely worked out. And even so, it didn't work. And it didn't work, and it just kept not working. So in the end, I just went, I don't know what it is, but I've got to put it to one side. So I did. I put it to one side for like 15 years. wrote all this other stuff, and suddenly one day went, oh my god, Amy's the perfect person to do all this cryptid investigation type stuff, but not as kind of like, she's the main character of the series,
mm-hmm.
but she's not the main character of Harker and Blackthorn. She's not the leader. The leader was always supposed to be Rebecca, but the main character was always supposed to be Amy, if that makes some sort of sense.
It makes total sense, and in much the same way as, you know, kind of Sherlock Holmes, the main character or the leader is actually, you know, Sherlock, but the storyteller, the one we're following, is Watson.
Yeah.
But actually I think Amy is a little bit more rounded out than Watson, obviously different period, different type of writing, etc. And you know, now that you've been saying this, I suddenly went, oh shit, I've been in this situation as well. And for me, it's been two things. One was with my character Shaylin.
Yeah.
Who was originally created with a friend of mine for something else entirely. And then the next was Aaron Nesek, who came to me in a writing exercise during class, and originally, yeah, it was just a completely different world, and then I thought it might be in the Kestrel world, but they're not going to have any kind of connection with one another. And then the next thing I knew was that Nesek and Shaylin, completely different stories, completely different times, were both integrated into the Kestrel saga world. And I know that at some point I do want to have some short stories which explore them, but I realised that, yeah, actually their stories and the things that I wanted to explore during these times, they were part of this world. They were part of Kestrel's world, Kestrel's story, not, you know, completely individual things. So there you go. It does happen.
And that's one of the things. I mean, the reason I struggled with the original Harker and Blackthorn, it wasn't even Harker and Blackthorn back then. Mm. It was just going to be Rebecca Harker by herself. The problem is she's quite an isolated, detached character, and you need people like Amy to actually bring her out. So when it was just her with no actual team or backing, there was nothing really to hang a story on.
Yeah, every Harker needs a Blackthorn.
Every Harker needs a Blackthorn. Or two.
Or two, indeed.
So comparing that to I can't even get through half a book writing for this character that I think is designed for this series too. I've written 5.5 books in this series with the same character and the same ideas, but with a different main character.
I'm also going to put this out for all of our listeners so that you can appreciate exactly why I'm so pissed off with Jules. She hasn't just written these five books. She's written these five books since the start of lockdown. I want you to think about that for a minute. I want you to think about how long it takes to write a book for you, and then appreciate that Jules fucking Ironside has written five.
Well,
five and a half. In fact,
yeah.
It's more than a half, let's be honest.
I'm going to finish book six by the end of November, I've decided.
Oh, I hate you.
Well, you hate me, but you're also getting the book a lot quicker, so there's that.
I really am, and this is the problem. I'm so jealous of you, but also, I like, as a fellow writer, I hate you. As a reader, I love you.
But a lot of that ease that we're talking about has come from the fact that suddenly I had the right cast for the series. This is sort of what I was getting at.
Yeah,
I wasn't meaning to humble brag or anything.
No. I get what you mean. Another thing is that when you have a side character who actually has bigger problems or more agency or is better tied to the plot than the actual protagonist, then they should probably be the protagonist.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think we've all at some point read something where we've gone, okay, that's interesting, but why are we reading it from this person's perspective, as I've just talked about with the other one?
Yeah.
Why are we reading it? It's just not as engaging, because instead of giving you a story with a protagonist tied to the plot who's really driven, is pushing everything along, you're tied to a protagonist who's kind of like a bit lukewarm connection with the plot, and
yeah.
It's actually putting a barrier between the reader and the story.
Yeah. Now, that's not to say that you can't do it successfully. Again, I'm going to mention Sherlock Holmes and Watson, but there was a very, you know, practical reason for why the story was told from Watson's point of view. And because it's because otherwise it would be really boring, because Sherlock figures things out really quickly. And Watson is the everyman who, you know, allows us into the story without just revealing everything straight off the bat. Being said, there are a few stories which are from Sherlock's point of view, but Watson is a more engaging character, I think, in many ways.
Definitely. And it's like things like... the name of the book's gone out of my head. I hate it when that happens. There are other books which use a filtering character, and it is a legitimate technique, but it's not something you want to do by accident. It should be chosen very deliberately, not a case of, no, I've determined that this book is going to be about this character. Yeah. Meanwhile, doing brilliant writing on this side character who's getting little to no screen time.
Does The Great Gatsby do it a little bit?
That's the one I was trying to say.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, The Great Gatsby absolutely does do it, and it is very deliberate. And I think it's a weird choice on the author's part, because it's kind of... He is putting an obstacle between us and the story, but if you consider the events of the story, there's quite a good reason for us to be distanced from it, so we can be a bit more objective, I think.
Absolutely.
Right. Here's the one that kind of gets me. The hero has no candy. Now, what I mean by candy is obviously not actual candy. The good stuff. You've got a protagonist and you haven't given them any of the good stuff. There should be, for every protagonist that you write, even if it's someone that you don't really like, you just feel compelled about and that you're interested in exploring, there should be at least one thing that they do really, really well, that they do better than everyone else. And it can be a really, really subtle thing. But it needs to be there. If you don't give your hero any candy, why on earth is anyone going to be interested in reading about them?
Yeah.
The converse is true. This is something that very particularly used to happen in the 80s version of the He-Man cartoon. He-Man had all the candy. All the candy. And therefore, it was a foregone conclusion that he would always win the day. And you find that in a lot of the 80s cartoons. You know that the protagonist is always going to win without too much of a struggle.
Sorry. I just thought of Resand.
There is an element of that. That I'm not going to lie. I mean, that is part of the problem with A Court of Wings and Ruin, is that Feyre has been given all the candy, and also Rhysand's been given all the candy, and suddenly the plot is flat.
And too much candy.
Too much candy. Too much candy results in no conflict. And yeah. not enough candy results in so much conflict that people get weary of it. I have to say, I felt a little bit like this with some of the Gentleman Bastard books.
Oh, did you?
That was one of the things that I think bugged me. I think by the time I got to book three, I was like, yes, I need them to have a significant enough win. I don't need it to happen every book, but I need a significant win for the main characters at least once every three books. And it just kind of, it didn't happen that way. And I know that's sort of how it's set up, but it was a case of, there's not enough candy going on here.
Okay, fair enough, I can see that.
So, I mean, you can have your main characters have two or three different things they're good at, and it may not be that they're better than everybody else, but combining those two or three things together gives them a skill set. This isn't the same as being a special individual snowflake handed a birthright. It can be something they've worked for.
Yeah.
So, for instance, in Harker Blackthorn, I've got Steve, and Steve is an absolute whiz at languages. He's really, really good. But he doesn't think anything of it. And obviously he's good at the things he's really interested in, but he doesn't necessarily value the skills very much. And everyone else is sort of standing around going, that's amazing.
It's the point where he just leans over and he starts translating Latin in real time. Just they're like, do-do-do-do-do. And Amy's like, what?
And this is something that Amy herself does. I mean, Amy's kind of like, I'm useless at languages and I can't draw and I can't dance at all kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's got quite a love of life and she's quite positive. And obviously that, you know, she's a whiz when it comes to maths and physics.
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
other things.
She does have, she does obviously have a special skill set as well. But I would say that of the three of them, they're all relatively evenly matched in terms of skill set.
Yeah, I'd agree. They balance each other out, which is quite nice. And it's not that it's an all-round as in, like, I'm skilled at absolutely everything, as you say. It's not lots and lots of candy all in one place. But that actually each of the different characters has got a different form of candy in different areas. This metaphor is getting strange. You know, combined, they've got a really nice mix, which works very, very well.
Yeah.
Together, they are one competent human being.
Most of the time. That's the other thing. It's like 85% of the time, they're one well-adjusted human being. But yeah, if you're going to have a sort of mixed bag group of people for your main characters, then absolutely have them complement and bounce off each other and get in each other's way as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's why I love Six of Crows so much is that you definitely have that. Each of them have their own skills, each of them have their own weaknesses, and sometimes that gets in the way of each other. You know, Jasper's gambling gets in the way of Kaz's plans, etc. You know, I just thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, definitely. We sort of wandered into point three, but that is basically that you've added the wrong supporting cast. So this is another problem. Yeah. You've got a great protagonist, you've got a great plot, a great story, and they're tied together, but your supporting cast is flat and there's no friction. And the thing I see this happen most with is when you have a supporting cast and they're basically a bunch of yes men. And they all get on.
Yeah.
They all love the main character. Again, this is the 80s He-Man. This is a kind of like, oh, yes, we don't like Prince Adam very much, but He-Man, he's our guy. What a guy kind of thing.
I just love that a guy can take his shirt off and suddenly...
I mean, he takes his shirt off, puts on some furry pants and a body harness and some deep tan, and that's apparently...
That's enough.
Looking back now, it's kind of like, oh my god, how did they get some of this really dicey shit past the censors? But but yeah, I mean, that is the problem. Everyone's like, oh, we know he's the good guy, so we're all going to agree with him. And they're kind of like endorsing the main character all the time. Whereas your supporting cast should be questioning the main character. You should have people going, no, Kestrel, that's a bad idea. For example.
There are so many people shouting at Kestrel that that's a bad idea. Literally, the last chapter I just wrote was her going head to head with Nessic, and she's just really pissing him off because he wants to do things the legal way, and she's like, "Meh, we don't really have time for that.
The law is for other people.
Yeah, he's like, the law isn't just for other people. And she goes, isn't it?
Yeah. I have that a bit with Rebecca. She's like perfectly law-abiding up until the point where it's inconvenient for her. And then suddenly it's kind of like, we'll do things my way. Totally chaotic good.
Anyway.
So yes, you should have friction and support between your supporting cast and your protagonist.
Essentially, your supporting cast should be their own fleshed out selves.
Yeah.
And very simply, I mean, if you've ever been in any kind of relationship, and I don't just mean romantic, I mean, you've had friends groups and stuff like that, people argue even if they love each other. People get in the way, people disagree, people misunderstand, people have different opinions. Okay, so that should be the case with your crew, even if they all do like each other.
Definitely. If you happen to find you have a character who adds nothing to this dynamic and nothing to the plot, and you could actually have the entire story without them, take the character out. Even if you love the character, get rid of them. You don't need them. They're just dead wood.
Throw them on the fire.
Well,
you can just put them in another document and you might be able to keep them for something else.
Yeah, absolutely. Nothing's ever really wasted in writing.
No.
Yeah, here's one that kind of really bugs me. It's when the hero and conflict are unrelated. So in the same way that your main character should be tied to the plot, they should also be tied to the main conflict.
Yes.
I've used the example here that, okay, let's imagine this is something that does happen, and it's happened to, say, Star Trek and things like that, where you spend seasons and seasons building up a rivalry between what is known as a good character and a bad character kind of thing, even though they trade capes back and forth because Star Trek is quite nuanced.
Yeah.
And then suddenly the writers go, oh shit, we don't have an antagonist for this main protagonist, and they steal another character's antagonist. And there's no relationship between them. So it's a bit like, imagine after 6 books of Harry Potter, Harry was sidelined and it was Hermione versus Voldemort. It's kind of like, that's not satisfying, is it? There's no personal relationship there. Hermione's just been assisting all the way through. And suddenly Harry's on the bench and it's like Hermione versus Voldemort. It's like, what does that resolve?
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree that there has to be a correlation there. Not just a correlation, there needs to be a direct link between your hero and your antagonistic force in some way. And even if it's... this is an interesting thing, because obviously you can have an antagonist who's a person, you know, a villain character, or you can have an antagonistic force, which is, you know, like a hurricane or a tsunami or zombies, you know, that they're not actually, you know, it's not that they've got a particular grudge or anything like that.
Yeah.
And even still, there's got to kind of be this relationship between what this hero is personally going through and what the antagonistic force has cost them and is costing them. And you need to see some kind of win in that regard. You need to see them win against it, whether it be they survive, whether it be they rescue their family, etc. And it would be very strange if suddenly they were kind of sidelined, having followed them the whole way throughout, and it was somebody else entirely who wasn't as invested in the same way, or who we weren't following in the same way, who suddenly gets that win instead.
Yeah, it's cheating your reader, basically.
I get
this from the sort of... you remember the big outcry there was over Game of Thrones and the fact that it was Arya who took out the Night King?
Yeah.
Even though, yeah, some of that was a bit red herring, because everyone's like, oh, it should have been Jon Snow. And actually, when you think about it, if you follow Arya's arc, she's the far more suitable person to take out the Night King. So it wasn't really cheating.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it actually made more sense in terms of the narrative that had been built. And I think people were kind of projecting things onto the character of Jon Snow that weren't necessarily there, because every time he was handed power, he did what he could to get rid of it.
He did. I do think, however, that the way that a lot of the stuff was built up with Jon Snow, his ending was just deeply unsatisfactory.
Yeah, I think that there are definitely things there. I mean, the one bit I wasn't going to quibble over was Arya's arc, but the rest of them, a lot of them were kind of like that. We haven't had enough space for this to for this to be the end. This doesn't make sense for a lot of it. I mean, even Jaime and Cersei kind of didn't really make sense.
No, they really didn't. And just also Jon Snow killing Daenerys in the way that he did didn't make any sense either. And Jon Snow actually being relatively useless in the battle also didn't make a lot of sense. You know, it was just very, very peculiar, very strange, I think, in a lot of ways. And I don't think it's going to... Well, I just wonder whether it will still fall that... The bricks will fall that way when it comes to the book. But yeah, I can feel why a lot of people felt quite betrayed by it.
But on the other hand, yes, you have things where clearly the author has gone... not on Game of Thrones particularly, but the author's gone, okay, I've been writing this huge long series and actually I'm now more invested in this character who's sort of gone from being a second tier character to being a like a co-protagonist. Mm-hmm. And they sort of nick off with the main antagonist.
Yeah.
Without, I'm sure there are ways that you can do it where it's not cheating your reader, but unless you'd prepare the ground properly, then you're absolutely cheating and your readers are going to get pissed off.
Yeah, and it is possible for a side character to become a main character.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to sort of to take over the story. And that does happen. And sometimes it happens for very good reason either. Like, for instance, again, Game of Thrones. Main character Ned Stark dies, obviously. But it was not exactly like he was the only runner in the race.
No.
Very strange race.
Yes. So... I mean, you can have side characters who have more agency. Again, that's usually an indication that you should be writing from that character's perspective.
Yeah.
When I say agency, I just mean that the character participates or has a greater connection to the plot. Mm-hmm. Agency isn't the same as being proactive, so it doesn't mean that this character is always going straight for the kill kind of thing. Sometimes it's just a case of, okay, well, things are being thrown at me, but I'm still being forced to make choices. If your protagonist is not being forced to make choices, however quiet and subtle they are, then they're not really being a protagonist. They're just kind of sitting there.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so actually, with all of this, I think the next thing we should think about is sort of casting calls and diversity.
Yeah, this is an important one, and it's obviously an issue that's quite close to my heart, and Madeline's as well.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing, just to recap again, your main character should be intimately tied to the plot. So your first priority is to select the best protagonist to tell the story.
Yeah.
So, if you want to write female-led fantasy, you should be thinking in terms of a story that is best told by a female protagonist. A discussion Alan and I had recently was, he was talking about the Assassin's Creed
is a different game different entirely. Game entirely.
Assassin's Creed, sorry, that was set in Greece. And
he
felt that there was a missed opportunity because you can obviously play as male or female characters. And mm-hmm. his point was that, yes, it is a fantasy, but at the same time, in ancient Greece, a woman would have had a completely different experience of the world to a man. And therefore, the storytellers could have given you two completely different stories with basically the same plot and the same main beats, as it were. And instead of what they'd done was given you a 6 foot something woman with the same name kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they've done the same thing with the new Assassin's Creed game with the Vikings as well. And honestly, it does bug me because yes, we should be looking from the perspective of, you know, it not mattering what your gender, etc. is. But at the same time, if we're looking at something that is deliberately setting itself in a historical context, you should also be thinking along the lines of how would this affect them? What other obstacles would they have to get over? Are there places women can go that men can't go kind of thing? And it is a missed opportunity in that respect. I don't like the idea of just taking a 6 foot something male character and then going, poof, you're female and that's it.
Yeah. And I think that there's two sides to this, because I do understand that sometimes people say, actually, I don't want to be dealing with gender politics. I just want to be running around
Yeah.
You know, with someone who looks vaguely like me just, you know, being an assassin. And I can really understand that. I can appreciate that. But in terms of storytelling, you do need to be conscious of the fact that, yes, gender, but also not just gender, you know, disability, ethnicity, you know, whether someone's neurodivergent or not, all of these things are going to play into the experience that a person has. And this doesn't need to be a humongous thing. I'm not saying that if you decide to write a character who is black, that their whole story needs to be about being, you know, black, which, and the problem is that people tend to go, oh, this is therefore going to be a story of hardship. Or it's the same whenever there's a gay character. It's like, but now we've got to show them being, you know, their whole life is about them being gay.
Or coming out.
They are, yeah.
It's yet another coming out story.
Yeah, exactly. And fine if the coming out stories, and also fine if you say, right, we're going to look at a sort of a black narrative and look at some of the difficulties that black people face in America or in England, etc. Totally fine. But the problem is that I think sometimes people think, oh, that's the only narrative that you can have. And you can, you know, address that experience in a more subtle way. For instance, one very small thing I did in Kestrel, one of my characters is of Indian descent. So his mother is Indian, his father is white British.
Yeah.
And he is training with Galahad, my knight character, who's teaching him how to fight. And Kestrel's like, oh, why can't you just go and train in the garden? And there's just this moment where this other character just turns around and goes like, because I'm pretty sure that if your neighbours looked out of their garden and they saw a black guy waving a knife around, they'd call the police. And she's like, yeah, I didn't think of that. And the thing is that she also thinks Galahad does it all the time. But what happens is the neighbours look over, they see this rippled, golden-haired, green-eyed, sort of gorgeous guy with his top off, waving around a sword. And they're like, whew, well, he must be an actor or something like that.
Yeah.
They have no problems with it. But, you know, it can just be small things like that. It can just be basically about understanding that the experiences that people have will differ depending what they are. And this whole story doesn't need to be about that. But, yeah, there should be a link there and you should be conscious of it. I completely agree.
It's something that I'm kind of butting my head against a bit with another character. Basically a third tier character in this Harker and Blackthorn series, and it's I want to be inclusive, and he is a trans character, which is great, and he's had some really unfortunate and unpleasant experiences, which means that he is now acting in a way that is not positive. It's not a good way to act, and it's not a good way to treat somebody that you care about. No. This is not me obviously saying, well, this is what I think it's like, you know, I'm not trying to project my experience on it. But at the same time, this is actually resonating as being quite realistic for this character at this time in their character arc. And it's trying to do it in such a way that I'm not, it doesn't look like I'm deliberately tarring an entire group of people. So it's a little bit of a headache, but it's absolutely worth the extra effort. And when I hear, I completely understand if you are a gamer and you just want to play, say, I want to play as a woman kind of thing. Great. That's fine. But the writers should be doing more than that. It's lazy to just say, oh, well, we'll just whitewash this character, or we'll just, you know, blackwash them.
Yeah. And again, this is, I think it's a completely different thing to say, you know, again, Assassin's Creed, it's meant to be a historical setting. I mean, that's one of the whole selling points of Assassin's Creed is, you know, its historical accuracy in a lot of ways, you know, other than all the, you know, science, mojo, supernatural stuff. We'll put that to the side. The fact is, you know, they've made great pains to make everything look right. You know, they've included characters and real people in history. It's different from playing Dragon Age, for instance, where actually there is, you know, there is actually racism in terms of with, you know, whether you're an elven character instead, because, you know, they were all treated like slaves and things like that. So you do have it on that level, but Yeah, it's different if you set in a fantasy setting and then go, actually, just be whoever you want, because in this particular world, we don't really have bigotry. But if you're setting it in the in you know, the modern day, or particularly in the past, you should recognise that, unfortunately, there have been some really shitty people and shitty opinions, and it would have affected the way that people kind of navigated the world. But I do understand the whole sort of, actually, I don't really want to deal with that. I deal with that day to day. I just kind of want to run around and, you know, lop the heads off people.
I mean, I absolutely can see it. It's just, I think you've got to be very careful not to feed into this narrative of tokenism. And I find that tokenism is really harmful for inclusivity in fiction.
Yeah, I would completely agree with you. Particularly because it tends to be so skin deep.
Yes.
It really is just, we've kind of just put this wallpaper in front of somebody and just said, ta-da! And it's like, but it's not. If I just look behind this curtain, it's the same person that it was before. No. We've got this diverse wallpaper. I'm like, you haven't done that. You've just changed the skin colour by like 3 degrees and you said, ha-ha, a black person. And it's not a black person, is it? It's the exact same person that it was before.
And it's very, very noticeable that the people who try and use, not everybody, but a lot of people who try and use diversity as a USP, kind of as an almost as an afterthought, tend to have just gone back to their manuscript and then colour washed or, you know, sexuality washed a couple of characters who aren't in the main grouping, as it were. It's really, really noticeable when somebody does that.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we're basically saying there is, yes, absolutely, cast diversely, and a certain amount of blind casting is fine, but you need to think about things and obviously do your due diligence.
Yeah, absolutely. It does make a difference, it really does.
Okay, so very briefly, a little bit about how we have assembled casts for our own current projects. Okay, here's a question for you, Madeline. How did you go about assembling a cast for Kestrel?
Okay, so how did I go about assembling a cast for Kestrel? I think Kestrel started with Kestrel and Galahad, very simply put. I had this idea where, okay, this is going to sound very strange. So at the time that I started writing Kestrel, I was really into pocket watches, and I had a lot of pocket watches. I loved them.
That is literally the last thing I expected you to say. Please get one.
I was super into pocket watches, and I was really into lockets as well. I just loved the idea of, you know, kind of clicking something open and there being something inside. And I got this thought about, and I was also obviously really into the Arthurian legends as well, and other legends as that as well. And I had this idea of a character who gets hold of a pocket watch or a locket or something like that, which contains the soul of a Knight of the Round Table, who's been around for years and years and years, and they just go off on an adventure together, basically. And it's just the two of them. And she's magical and he's a knight. And so it just started with them. It was always them, right at the centre of it, their dynamic, their kind of relationship. And then I really did just start writing it, and I actually started writing what is now probably going to be book 3 originally, and then went, no, actually, I've got to look back at where these two started. How did they begin? And it was like everything kind of fell into place a little bit, is that as I was writing them, other people sort of reared their heads, and they came in from sort of the periphery or some came fully formed, some have changed over time. And then, as I said, characters like Shaylin and Nesek and Sammy, who is now introduced in book one of Kestrel, was originally a character from Nesek's story, which I started writing completely unrelated at a different time. And so these characters all converged from three different stories that I was writing and into the same world. And that's, I guess, how I assembled them, as they kind of were needed. It was quite an organic process, and it's been very enjoyable. What about you?
Well, as I already mentioned, I had the idea for the cryptid type series, and I had the character, and it didn't work. It didn't work right up until I was like, you know what, I reckon Amy could have her own spin-off series. I was like, what would Amy do? That was the question. What would Amy do? And obviously what Amy would do is look for cryptids.
Yes. I mean, it was that or serial killers.
It was so. That or serial killers. I might have to get a serial killer in here somehow as well at some point.
Yay!
Somehow.
I'm actually kind of curious of how the cast of The King's Knight came about, because that is an amazing cast.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I was commissioned to write a series of books set around the rule of Richard II. And my original suggestion was kind of like, this is the time period. And the time period was, you know, my publisher was like, yes, we like the idea of the time period. Don't like your idea of a main character. Write about a knight. And I'm like, okay, if I'm going to write about a knight, I'm going to write about the sort of knight I want to write about.
Yeah.
Which is how this curmudgeonly, grumpy, disillusioned, misanthropic, huge, ugly bear of a man came into being. Don't be fooled by the cover of book three. They've made Gregory look really quite dishy, and actually he's really not.
They really have, haven't they? I always just feel like, damn!
It's kind of like, okay, yes, no. We can see what his wife sees in him now, but no, that's not what he's like at all. And I think what appealed to me about Gregory was the fact that he was an outsider. And he starts with, you know, we were talking about Candy earlier. He does have Candy in the sense of he's very good at what he does, and what he does is be a mercenary. So he's very good at getting in there and fighting. And he's got quite a good strategic mind. In fact, he's probably a bit too good at getting in there and fighting.
Sorry, it's that brilliant scene where they're like, all right, whatever we do, let's not antagonise anybody. And Gregory's like, absolutely, let's not antagonise anybody. The first person they meet is like, hey, hand over your sword. And Gregory's like, fuck that! And immediately goes into fight. And I was like, you are too keen! Yeah.
Stop and then obviously he and Chaucer wake up later in a cellar having been knocked out, and Chaucer's managed to talk them out of killing him. So anyway, you started off with this misanthrope, and that's an interesting person to follow, but if you leave someone like that who has violent tendencies because that's how they've had to live their life for the last 10 years, you know, all the polish, all the human society and everything's been stripped away long ago, and you know, he's learned that this sort of boyish ideal of the knight's code is actually a load of bollocks. That's somebody who could quite easily end up just doing something a little bit worse and a little bit worse and a little bit worse until you've actually got someone who's genuinely an anti-hero and a nasty piece of work. So you need just someone to balance that. One of Gregory's redeeming graces is the fact that he doesn't take any pleasure in hurting people, which, you know, sounds like that's baseline decency, and it is, but this is medieval era when everything was very up in the air and there's a high state of lawlessness, so you have to be a little bit willing to defend yourself. And he goes slightly beyond in the sense of finding this essentially abused child who's an indentured servant, essentially a slave, and not being able to stop himself from interfering. All the way through, he's kind of telling himself not to interfere.
Yeah. I do love the introduction of Cuthbert, though, because I remember when you were writing, you said, should I keep this character or should I not? And you were umming and ahhing about it. And I was like, keep him.
I'm like, is it?
I think you were doubting yourself because you thought, you wondered whether people would like him.
Yeah, I didn't want to go down the clever servant route, you know, where you have a the sort of Blackadder thing, where you've got a very, very clever, clever servant. And but that's not really what it was. It was, it's the thing with your supporting cast, it should bring out things in your main character. And in Gregory's case, it was kind of like, it brought out a slightly softer side, and he resented every single second of it.
He really did. It was beautiful, though, because he's just there, like, it's like, are you being soft? I am not. Now eat this food.
Shut up. Eat. You're too skinny. So
you haven't started the fire yet? Move over, I'll teach you.
So you had him and Cuthbert, and then Cuthbert persuades him to intervene in a fight where he's sure that this man who's been set on by bandits in a back street in London is going to get stabbed to death. Gregory's kind of pissed off anyway, and can't bring himself to disappoint this small lad that he's, you know, rescued and is kind of regretting rescuing. And that's how he ends up with Chaucer as part of his team as well.
I do like the fact that Chaucer was literally introduced just as a joke right at the beginning, just waxing poetry, and then suddenly that's it, he's a main character.
Yeah, see, again, this is publisher interaction. The publisher was like, got the first book and was like, it's brilliant, really, really enjoyed Chaucer, bring Chaucer back. And I'm like, okay, he was supposed to be a cameo in the first book, but I'll see what I can do. And obviously Gregory's wife, in the sense of he's so...
Yeah.
His brother has so completely run the estate into the ground before conveniently dying of a fever that Gregory is forced to go into a marriage of convenience, which isn't terribly convenient at all, in order to raise enough funds to keep his estate going, so that he can stay as a baronet and not just become a landless knight. And again, the thing that saves him in that relationship again is this core shred of decency, where he is not willing to hurt someone just because they're weaker or more vulnerable than him.
Yeah.
So even though he's kind of like, he kind of thinks of himself as not as just being a brute, because that's how he's been living for such a long time. And every time he sort of holds his hand and treats somebody well, they kind of look at him a bit differently, and it forces him to reassess what he's really like.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it is just wonderful. I love it.
So weirdly, it was part of Gregory's character, was the fact that he's got this core of decency and I need to find ways to bring it out. And that was how the cast assembled around to that idea.
Yeah. I love it. I do think that we've reached the end of our episode.
We have, yep.
Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and Jules, I believe that you have one for us.
I do. I've just finished Shauna Maguire's most recent book of short stories. It's called Dying With Her Cheer Pants On, Tales of the Fighting Pumpkins, and it's all about cheerleaders, but from a very speculative fiction angle. So let's imagine that there is reality as we know it, and let's imagine that outside reality as we know it is an alternate reality full of great, big, terrible, dark creatures that hunger. And the only thing standing between us and our, you know, relatively peaceful way of life, and these forces on the outside, are little teams of people. So, for example, you have the Fighting Pumpkins, who are a cheerleading squad. And in other parts of the world, it will be a team of intrepid reporters, or a group of teen detectives, or the chess club, or something like that. And everyone in their own area does their own little bit of fighting, as it were. But we're following the Fighting Pumpkins, and the people of Johnson's Crossing know that strange things happen to the cheer squad. Sometimes entire cheer squads just disappear, and you mourn them and you move on. And then, mysteriously, the next cheerleading squad is called, kind of thing. And that's what's happening with the Fighting Pumpkins. And it's mostly funny and a little bit absurdist as these cheerleaders go up against threats from outer space and Lovecraftian horrors and other cheerleading teams, obviously. But it's really intelligently done as well. It's kind of like, yeah, we can be girls, we can have immaculate hair and makeup, and we can still absolutely kick ass.
That's very cool.
Very, very good. It's a great... And obviously, Shauna Maguire's quite a folklorist as well. So I appreciated that. There was an entire story in there that really tapped into something that I've written about myself recently, which I won't go into, but it had to do with all the British folklore of temporary monarchs, shall we say.
Ah, me gusta.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's really interesting, and it's funny, and there's a bit of heart-wrenching stuff in there too, so I highly recommend that book.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do get in touch with us and tell us about how you build your characters. Is there anything in this episode you've agreed with or things that you've disagreed with? We'd love to hear from you. Remember, you can get in contact with us via Facebook or via Tumblr or via Twitter. On that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks. Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.